I just want to read you the Wikipedia synopsis of the 1997 movie. At the Croker Beauty Pageant, Helen witnesses Barry being murdered on the balcony, but finds no sign of the killer or Barry. The police officer escorting her home is murdered by the killer. Helen runs to her family's store where the killer murders her sister Elsa. She escapes and runs toward the street, but the killer slashes her to death. What? I mean, that's just a lot. That's a lot.
It's a lot of murdering.
Hello world, there's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the big wheel generation who grew up knowing that the call was coming from inside the house.
Oh no, it's terrifying. We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today we'll be saving the book that just won't quit, the 1970s classic that keeps coming back in every new generation with new covers, movie adaptations again and again and again. Lois Duncan's I Know What You Did Last Summer.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
I know what you did last summer. Just lie to me, there's no other. I know what you did last summer. Tell me where you've been. I know what you did last summer.
In 1973, Lois Duncan, the pioneering and prolific author of books for and about teens, released the book I Know What You Did Last Summer, a pop culture juggernaut that has spawned tons of iterations and adaptations spanning five decades, meaning that no matter what generation you identify with, boomer, Gen Xer, millennial, Gen Z, or alpha, I Know What You Did Last Summer has a version for you. The basic premise of that original 1973 book is that a group of friends, Barry and Helen and Julie and Ray, accidentally kill a boy on his bike while driving a dark country road. And instead of stopping to help him, they keep driving, making a pact to never tell anybody what they've done. Exactly 1 year after the accident, a note appears in Julie's mailbox with a simple message. I know what you did last summer. And whoever wrote that message is super pissed. And over the course of the novel, he appears to be seeking revenge. The book has been in print over 50 years and has had, by my count, at least 15 different covers. And I swear I saw this somewhere, but now I can't really verify it. So don't Google it. I think it's sold over 10 million copies. And part of the reason it sold so many copies is because the book has given birth to not just a movie, but a movie franchise, and those movies keep the book alive for subsequent generations. So there was a 1997 movie, a full 24 years after the book, called I Know What You Did Last Summer, starring Sarah Michelle Gellar, her future husband Freddie Prinze Jr., Jennifer Love Hewitt, and Ryan Phillippe, which is basically like the 1990s Brat Pack. Then there was a 1998 sequel called I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, a 2006 straight-to-video sequel to the sequel called I Always Know What You Did Last Summer. Oh my God. A 2021 limited series that was canceled after one season called I Know What You Did Last Summer. And now, just a few months ago, we have a brand new sequel to the 1997 movie called I Know What You Did Last Summer, with Jennifer Love Hewitt and Freddie Prinze Jr. reprising their roles as now middle-aged Julie and Ray. So like I said, I've counted like 15 different covers, basically a new one every few years, including the 1997 movie tie-in edition of the novel featuring the 1990s Brat Pack on the cover. And that sold, that one iteration of the book with the Brat Pack on the cover,
yeah,
sold 517,000 copies in 1 year. It's the book that will never die, even if you accidentally run over it on a dark country road.
I mean, that is not a surprise at all that the book with them on the cover,
yeah,
sold so many, because my God, they were just beautiful.
They were a really beautiful 1990s quattro, weren't they?
I know. They are. I feel like it should have died. when I feel like a car should have driven over.
Let's just say it. Yes. Let's just say it. Did you guys read it when you were growing up? Or what is your experience with I Know What You Did This Summer? Wait, not this summer. Last summer.
God. Do you know what you did last summer?
I cannot remember.
I know what I did last night. I mean, are you
kidding? Even know what I did this summer.
I did read it in the 70s when it came out, and I loved it. And I think that was because this was my first little foray into this whole genre of suspense and, you know, just kind of that edge of your seat reading and trying to figure it out. And I'm pretty sure it was right around the same time I would have read Are You in the House Alone? That 1976 Richard Peck novel. Yep. They both live in the same place in my mind.
The call is coming from inside the house. Okay. That's where that comes from. Okay, yes. Good.
Yes. And so those are all in that same, realm for me. And I loved those kind of books. And Richard Peck's even won the Edgar Award for Best Juvenile Fiction in 1977. So it was a big deal.
It was a really big deal.
This whole genre was, and there were other ones that if you showed me the covers, I probably would have said, oh yeah, I read that one too.
Yep.
But I loved that kind of, that genre and that mystery. And also this is that tiptoeing into almost young adult. Like I'm getting out of that, younger kind of reading,
it's not Judy Bloom and stuff like that. It's not Beverly Cleary.
It is not.
Yeah.
And it's about teens doing kind of crazy, naughty things. And I think that's what is the hallmark of a young adult novel, which, by the way, you just said Richard Peck won the Edgar Award for Best Juvenile Fiction Book because there was no young adult designation. Lois Duncan was really at the forefront of writing books about teens that are for teens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I honestly can't remember if I read it or not, but I definitely remember the original cover. So maybe my sister had it. Yeah, that one that they're kind of off to the side. They're almost like silhouettes with the bike, the kids. Isn't that the one?
Is it pastel-y or is it photorealism?
I think it's pastel-y.
Okay, that's the hardcover. I think that is the OG.
Yeah. And so maybe my sister had it because I was not. And by saying certainly because this book has gone on generation, just because I wasn't old enough in, the early 70s to read it, that doesn't matter. But I was really never a fan of that genre, the murdery, scary books.
Yeah.
And the thing about this one, though, is it's not too murdery and scary. The book isn't,
It really isn't.
I was much more interested in middle school and high school and like Sweet Dreams and Norma Klein type books, more like relationship books.
Yeah.
Whether that was a family relationships, like say Norma Klein type books or the Sweet Dreams romances.
Yeah.
But Lois Duncan, I mean, I remember all of those books because they were at the Scholastic book fairs and
so
they were in
many.
The Scholastic book orders.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I do remember reading, I just have to mention it because we're not going to talk about it after this, but I was so freaked the fuck out by this book, you guys. And I read that whole thing probably several times. It was called Five Were Missing. And it was later retitled and called Ransom. It was about five kids who are on the school bus.
Yes.
And the bus driver just passes their stops and he kidnaps them. Takes them to like this shack and he locks them in there. And then it's all about the ransom and then the relationships and how they're going to get out and everything. And I rode the school bus, so I was so freaked out. I used to think about it all the time. Like, what if like our school driver's name was our school bus driver's name was Sylvia when I lived in Washington? And that's probably when I read it because I used to think, what if Sylvia is really like an awful kidnapper? And she wasn't. She was so nice. I loved Sylvia. But anyway, I think just her name is Lois Duncan, right? That name is so familiar to me. She did write Hotel for Dogs, so that is a little bit more, a kid-friendly book.
Yeah.
But the other one I just wanted to mention, just because when I was looking at all of her titles, the other one that jumped out to me, so maybe I read it, but do you guys remember Killing Mr. Griffin?
Yes. That one I really, really remember. Yes, that's the one that almost was more important to me than I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that came out in 1978, so that's very much in our Scholastic Book Fair era that we would have seen it. But anyway, back to I Know What You Did Last Summer. I think this might have been the first time I read it. It wasn't, but it wasn't memorable to me if I read it before. And I'm so surprised that it wasn't.
I don't think I read it. I really don't. And until I perused all the covers, I would have told you that I wasn't even aware of it until 1997 when the movie came out. But all of those 1980s covers were all familiar to me. I was very familiar with every single one of those covers, probably from the Scholastic Book Fair or from the Spinners at Snyder's. And of course, just the title is like a phrase we've always known. It's not like the 1997 movie came out and I was like, oh, I wonder what this is about. If you came of age in the 70s or the 80s, this book was like wallpaper. It just was. You just knew it.
You know, that's a really good point, because if you think about it, like, you know, Flowers in the Attic, V.C. Andrews books, I was very into those because they weren't like as much, I want to say they weren't as murdery. I don't know. I think that Lois Duncan was kind of synonymous with these types of this
somebody
genre.
Died. Like
Carolyn
right.
Said,
somebody
like,
died.
But I Know What You Did Last Summer was almost like a Flowers in the Attic or a Forever. Yeah. If I didn't read it, I knew what it was about. We were all talking about it.
Yep. Right.
There was lore.
You knew about that note. You knew the note said, I know what you did last summer.
Right. I mean, you can just say that to a Gen X, well, really to any generation now, as you pointed out. But just that one line, or same with, are you in the house alone?
Yes.
You know, knowing the calls coming from inside the house. Those are just one-liners that you can say to somebody and they immediately know what you're talking about. And
they do.
Again, is there a book that our kids' generation has that they could just say one? Well, there probably is. But yeah, it was that much a part of the zeitgeist.
It was. It really, really was. And I was really more in the Richard Peck category than I was Lois Duncan. For whatever reason, I have no idea. I think his books were more ghosty. And that could be one reason. Like, I remember a book called Ghosts I Have Been, which was from the Scholastic Book Fair for sure. And I loved that book. I loved that book. And Lois Duncan's were much more in the real world, kids killing adults. That's what was happening.
They or were other little so or kids
on a bike.
Kids killing kids.
Yeah. Kids killing kids on a bike. Yeah. So there was a People magazine article that came out just this summer when the new version of the movie came out. And it was so interesting because I can't believe how little we knew about Lois Duncan.
I know.
I cannot believe the content of this article. And how did we read all of these books? And how is she so much a part of the zeitgeist, as you said, without us knowing this factoid? So apparently Lois Duncan hated the movies. She really hated the movies because, in her words, they turned them into slasher movies.
Right.
And I agree with her on this point. This is a quote that comes directly from, this is awkward. It's a quote that comes from a book that is quoted in the People magazine article. And I'm sorry, I don't have
it. It was hard to understand.
It was really hard to understand.
That makes me mad.
I made a flowchart.
It's just, a lot of that kind of writing now, it's just like they're doing a research paper. They don't even talk to any of the people. They're just like, oh, let's find a quote in this case, another book, and I'll include it in this article. Yeah. But I never really talked to any of the people.
It's almost like they're saying, like, my cousins, aunts, brothers, cousins, uncle.
Yes.
And you're like, you're trying to follow it. So, yeah. So,
and I feel bad we don't have the proper designation. What's the word I'm looking for? Citation. We don't have the proper citation for you, but we'll put the link to the People magazine article so you can see the author and the book that this actually comes from. And what Lois Duncan said, and again, I cannot believe that we don't know this. So she said, it was my characters and my plot gimmick, but then it went in all directions. I was quite horrified by the sensationalized violence. Several years earlier, my own teenage daughter, Kate, had been chased down in her car and shot to death. And I had seen right in front of my eyes what real violence is. To have people screaming and laughing about it did not go down well, is what she said. And the author says, while she was not happy with the movie, she was admittedly happy with the fact that the book had been made into a movie, because that made all of her backlist very popular. And she sold
a lot
more
books. You know, you'd have to be a liar to say that you didn't like that. Did you guys see that movie, the 1997 movie?
No, I never did.
I didn't, because I'm not a horror slasher movie person, but
it's
sort of like when I read that, and I had just read the book for this episode, you know, she says in the movie, and all of you guys listening, they love this movie, by the way. We know this, and they're screaming at us right now because we didn't see it and don't love it. But apparently, and I'm going to say it, and they're going to be like, of course there's a character called the fisherman with the hook. I didn't know about this.
That wasn't in the book. Like the thing no, that the no. Lois Duncan books were a little bit more palatable, right? Because you could kind of like Carolyn was saying, like you could test your toes in this kind of genre, in this water, right?
Yes.
Like, because it wasn't bloody and so murdery, but in the movie, I guess there's a character here, with a fisherman hook?
Let's just read the synopsis of the movie. So essentially what happened, she's correct. They took the premise, kids, kill somebody, don't tell anyone, make a pact, and receive a note that says, I know what you did last summer. That's where it ends. And the names of the people. Here is what the movie poster says. If you're going to bury the truth, make sure it stays buried. After an accident on a winding road, four teens make the fatal mistake of dumping their victim's body into the sea. Not in book. Exactly 1 year later, the deadly secret resurfaces as they're stalked by a hook-handed figure.
We're talking like, you know, what's the guy's name from Friday the 13th or whatever?
Like Michael Myers or something.
Yeah, it was like they were trying to create a Michael Myers character.
And the director has said that is exactly what he was trying to do. His hook-handed figure is trying to create a Freddy Krueger or Jason or a Michael Myers. That's exactly what he was trying to do. And he was basing it on his, he took the story that Lois Duncan created and he set it in his hometown in on the coast of North Carolina where there are a lot of fishermen. And so the hook-handed figure is a dead fisherman, I guess.
Well, and listen, it's Kevin Williamson is the guy who's doing this. And here's the thing with what he did, take an idea from a book that was popular, but then we know now these other slasher movies are, you know, making big box office,
Scream.
Right? So I'm going to add a slasher element to it, but it's going to be a fisherman with a hook. This is all fine as long as a couple things happen. One, you make sure you say based on the book by Lois Duncan, which it might have.
Yeah.
But two, you do a little research into this author. And when you're researching and you discover that her daughter was killed so violently and horrifically, you then say, I'm going to find a different book to do this on. Mm-hmm. I just feel like it was so super insensitive and horrible and unforgivable, in my opinion, what Kevin Williamson did to Lois Duncan.
Yeah.
And how she was not a part of any of that. That's something, too, that I guess I'm curious about when a book is sold, the rights or whatever, to make a movie or a TV show or whatever. How much does the original author have in terms of a say in how they adapt this book? Because obviously she didn't even know it was happening until I think she said she saw the movie or whatever.
Yeah, she literally
so
saw the movie.
Was run by her. So I guess when she signed the little contract, it was take it all and you don't have to run anything by me.
It does, you know, your contract can vary greatly, and sometimes you're literally just signing over a license to do whatever they want with it. And it sounds like that's what happened because, like you said, Carolyn, she had no idea what would be in the movie till she sat in the movie theater. So here's the actual story as it happened. This is so sad. Duncan's daughter, Caitlin Arquette, was shot to death in 1989 at the age of 19, and she was murdered the summer after she graduated from high school. And this is all from this People magazine article. Yep. At the time of her killing, she was driving home from a friend's house when she was struck in the head by two bullets that entered the driver's side of her red Ford Tempo. And it wasn't until July of 2021, which is 5 years after Lois Duncan died, that a man finally confessed to not just three murders, but also three rapes. And one of the murders, of course, was her daughter. So he was sentenced to 45 years. 45 years in prison.
That's what I said.
45
that
years.
That is insane.
You kill three people and rape three women and you get 45 years?
I didn't understand that at all.
Maybe he's super old and he's going to die in prison. But
who
I mean,
cares?
Trauma is – I cannot – it's – obviously, I have no words. We have no words. That's all we can say about that. And then for her to be subjected to this slasher film is based on her work. I think I understand. I'm really sorry about that, Lawson.
And I feel really sad, too, because – so she wrote a book called Who Killed My Daughter in 1992.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Kind of
that's
a memoir-ish. Right. And then she actually had a sequel in 2013 called One to the Wolves on the Trail of a Killer. And her whole, that was her whole mission after her daughter died was to find this killer. And it's so sad that she didn't obviously live to see that actually happen, but it was something she, till the day she died, she was in search of. And it's just sickening. And then just that weird kind of, I don't know what the word is. There's probably a better word than irony or something, but that somehow.
It's a bitter irony. It's a bitter irony.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This is just to characterize the slasher film status of the 1997 movie. So I read you the premise of the book at the top. That was pretty accurate. Not pretty accurate. That's exactly what the movie is about. It's not that it's devoid of violence. There is violence, but it's pretty run of the mill, like network TV style violence in the 70s, not now. I just want to read you the Wikipedia synopsis of the 1997 movie. At the Croker Beauty Pageant, Helen witnesses Barry being murdered on the balcony, but finds no sign of the killer or Barry. The police officer escorting her home is murdered by the killer. Helen runs to her family's store where the killer murders her sister Elsa. She escapes and runs toward the street, but the killer slashes her to death. Ooh. I mean, that's just a lot. That's a lot.
It's a lot of murdering.
It's a lot of murder.
I'm just go back to what I said, like, you know, how... Yeah, bless Lois Duncan's heart, how she's like, but at least it made people know my books and everything. And that's true. But but how did they go forward with this?
Yeah.
It's so wrong.
Yeah.
And it's so – there's a lot of other stories that he could have based his slasher,
Exactly.
Murdering.
Or just – You know, my theory or my idea is that he liked the premise of this. They did something bad, you know, the summer before, and now they're being, you know, taunted with this a year later.
Yep.
Beyond that, like when you read the similarities and the names of the characters, there is nothing similar.
It's not the
and
same. Yeah.
Is there a fear that if you take this premise of a story that Lois Duncan would come and say, you stole that from my idea and I'm going to sue you
not if they paid for it. I mean,
I know, but originally, like, so they paid for it.
Yeah.
And as someone who read the original, it just makes me sick to my stomach when you just read that description. And it's like murder, murder, murder there. It's two totally different things. So to have much like when she goes in to see the movie, if I had gone in like that, I would have been, this isn't even anything like this. It's kind of not fair in a lot of ways. It's not fair to the book. It's not fair to Lois Duncan because
he should have just bought the premise and then not called it that.
Right.
Yeah. Buy the premise from her, credit her, and make a different movie.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how pissed off you would be if you went and saw the movie first. Say you're only like 17 in 1997.
Yes.
You go
yes.
see the movie and you're like, this is awesome. I'm going to go buy the book. And then the book
really
is as milquetoast as it is. We're about to talk about that.
Yeah.
But the book is so almost just like, huge eye roll now. But
it's a big nothing burger.
You would be really mad. I would be like, I need my money back for that book because it's so different. And they don't – I thought they were exactly the same until like yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is interesting. The 2025 movie, which you can stream right now, like I said earlier, is a sequel to the 1997 film. And that little tagline for it is, you get the ending you deserve. When five friends inadvertently cause a deadly car accident, they cover up their involvement and make a pact to keep it a secret rather than face the consequences. A year later, their past comes back to haunt them and they're forced to confront a horrifying truth. Someone knows what they did last summer and is hell-bent on revenge. So this sounds exactly the same, right? But remember, this is a sequel. How is it a sequel? Because it's a brand new accident. Like, oh my God, it happened again.
Yeah, because now there are five friends.
There are five friends.
And then I read that they go back and they are like, hey, this happened to those older, that middle-aged couple, Ray and Julie, a long time ago. Like, did they just get out of jail? I don't even know. So they're like, let's go talk to them. And also, can I just say something else? For me, and I know listeners, a lot of you disagree with me. You love really slashery. Yeah,
there's a place for that. Yeah,
bloody films. To me, psychological horror is way scarier.
Oh, like, yeah, for sure,
110%.
They could have made like, I know what you did last summer. Like, you do something, you cover it up, and then you just start getting these notes. That can be made really freaky. Like
that's super scary. Looking over your shoulder constantly.
Yes. Yeah. I feel like that would have been way more effective.
For me, that would have been scarier. And like Michelle said, the new accident where they're like, oh my God, I can't believe it happened again. And so they know Julie and Ray had this happen to them back in 1973. And so they go and find 46-year-old Jennifer Love Hewitt and 51-year-old Freddie Prinze Jr. were like, so you guys, what should we do? The thing that is funny is that Sarah Michelle Gellar was invited back to reprise her role as Helen. But as you heard in the Wikipedia thing above that I read, Helen got slashed to death in the street. So to Sarah Michelle Gellar's credit, she refused because Helen was killed in the 1997 movie and she did not want to, vocabulary word, retcon her death. Retcon stands for retroactive continuity. Like they're just going to bring Helen back from the dead, pretend she didn't die, or maybe she's a ghost.
They do that all the time. And yeah.
She's and like, no, I'm not doing
queen
it.
Queen of that. Or,
yeah.
Well, yeah, she could have been her twin sister that we never knew.
Yeah,
about.
Good for her. Go ahead. Yeah, twin sister. Right. It could have been twin sister. Okay, Carolyn, I have a little nugget for you. Okay. About the, yeah, my cousin, it's always a cousin. Like you look identical to your cousin. That's not a thing. You don't even look identical to your siblings.
Identical cousins. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's such a 70s cartoon thing. Okay. So this little interesting nugget is for Carolyn. So for the beginning of the 1997 film, the coastal areas of Sonoma County, California, stood in for that North Carolina setting where the director grew up. And the opening shots of the movie, where the sun is setting on a rugged coast, were filmed on Highway 1 in the town of Jenner.
Get out of town.
I know. You guys, this is where Carolyn and I stayed when we... We almost missed our flight home from San Francisco. When we went for our little Bodega Bay excursion this March, we stayed in a little Airbnb in the town of Jenner. I mean, it's like population 4. Right. And this is where the opening scenes of that movie are filmed. And then the car crash scene, which is the impetus of the movie, was also filmed on Highway 1 in the same area. And Carolyn, I swear to God, it could be the place where I really urged you to ignore the red light on the two-lane hairpin road. We would have died. I think it's a for sure that we would have died. There was construction on the road, on the two-lane hairpin curve, cliffside road where, you know, some people, if you just turn an inch too much, you'll go into the ocean. And they had narrowed it down to one road, and there was a stoplight there. Yes, one lane.
Yeah.
Because they were doing construction, and so they put the temporary stoplights, and there was a red light. And so we stopped at the red light, and we're the very first car. We're the first car. There is no action. We're sitting there for like 7 minutes. I'm like, Carolyn, I think it's broken. And I think we can just go. And Carolyn's like, no, I can't.
No, you can't.
Like, just go. It's clearly broken. There are 100 cars behind us. There are no cars coming. There are no cars coming toward us at all. And I didn't see any construction. I'm like, just go. Well, like 30 seconds later, then cars start coming. I'm like, oh, shit, we would have legit died. We would have gone into the ocean and died.
Because once it did turn green and we were allowed to go, and then we, you know, obviously traveled that path, I just kept saying to Kristen, we would have died. There is not a question in my mind that we would not be on this planet. It was so scary. I'm just like so grateful to my dad and that I stood my ground because Kristen can convince me to do a lot of things that maybe I don't always want to do. Mm-hmm. But this, I was like, no, I mean, I crept up a little. I kept thinking it was one of those things like, oh, I'm just not over the sensor. Yeah, I have to trigger it. And then I thought, well, if somebody goes around me, then maybe I'll go behind
Make
them.
Make them go first.
But it was, and then it was the pressure of being the first car because, you know, it's triggering all of those, like, I don't want the people behind me mad at me. Like, that was a huge thing traveling that whole road. Uh-huh. I don't want this stranger who I'll never see in my entire life mad at me. I just thought, oh gosh, somebody's going to be mad at me. Kristen wants me to go.
And they're all like, go. Why aren't you going? But Carolyn stood her ground. She's like, no, I'm not going. I'm staying here.
Yes, thank God. Uh-uh. And you know what's so ironic, too, Kristen, that you and I can both speak to, is that there are no cliffs in North Carolina. Like, you're not going to, like, get in an accident off of a windy hairpin turn, cliffy, hilly road next to the beach. I mean, it could not be flatter in North Carolina.
I never even thought of that. There are no cliffs to fall off of in North Carolina.
Do people think we're stupid? We'll get into this later.
Right.
But I am just mad when people think that I'm stupid. And I'm not stupid, people, just so you know.
Okay, so in that beginning scene, it gets even better. So the first scene of the 1977 movie, after you see the crash, and by the way, a crash, can you imagine, Carolyn, on that two-lane cliffside hairpin road? I mean, that's the end of the movie right there as far as I'm concerned. I've had all the fright that I need. So in that first scene is a bunch of kids, these friends, they're around a campfire on a beach next to a wrecked boat, like turned upside down. And so the art department went and found that old boat in Bodega Bay. Everybody who's been listening to this for a long time or who has read Worldwide Crush, you know all about Bodega Bay. It's the home of Rory Calhoun. They found that old boat in Bodega Bay. They cut it in half and they placed it on the beach as a prop in the first scene of I Know What You Did This Last Summer. Who I keep saying knew? This summer. I don't
Again.
Know
yeah.
Again. Always right. And still.
We still know what you did last summer.
Okay, so one thing that we discovered when we were picking up this book for the first time in 52 years, I was uninformed. I just picked it up cold, and I start reading the book from 1973, and he talks about having GPS. And I was like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. How? And then there's a reference to a cell phone. I'm like, no, what? So then I had to do a little bit of Googling. And what we found out is that there was a 2010 update to I Know What You Did Last Summer. In order to make it more attractive to contemporary kids, to make it not sound old, and they wouldn't even understand some of it, I suppose. So I just want to know, what was your opinion of that quote? I'm using quote fingers, the update. Did it make it more readable and easier to identify with? I'm laughing.
No, I had the 2020 update, actually. So mine was only 5 years. I noticed it right away, and I just started – I was reading it on my Kindle, and I just started flagging things. Yeah, things like
she seldom texted him.
Yeah, I have pages of it. You know, Barry likes to drive the Lexus. They go to Starbucks. I get that the – I get why they did it. I get why the antiquated references, because I'm going to read some in just a minute that are so – kids today wouldn't even know what they mean. But they left the antiquated references.
This
is what I was about to say. Yeah. I get that they would turn them off, but the fact that they left so many of them in, so they come right after a new thing, it's so obvious. For instance, like it might say something about texting or using a phone, and then all of a sudden it talks about, it'll say like a quote, like it's on the front page of the phone directory. Written in red, or she takes something, she goes and she looks at the phone book. I just feel like it was too inconsistent.
It was incredibly inconsistent.
And then they don't even always make sense. Like some of the ones that say things like, I don't know what this means, you guys, but this is a quote directly from the 2020 version. She even DJs her own webcast in the afternoon.
The girl DJs that didn't graduate from high school because she won the contest.
Here's another one. I don't think that kids today would get this at all. We know what this means, but I don't think kids today would. I'd like it even better if the prettiest girl here wasn't all tied up to some jerk before I can even get my bid in.
What is
get
that?
My bid in.
Is that 1973 that they didn't take out?
But then the next sentence says, have you been hooked up with this guy for long? Not have you been hooking up with this guy for long?
Have you been hooked up with this guy?
And then she says, almost 2 years, we were steadies in high school.
1973.
Oh, we were steadies. Do you think kids today? So they're mixing.
Yeah.
They're mixing it all in one.
It's like mixed metaphors.
The same sentence. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. I was picturing, and Lois Duncan did not do this update, I don't think. I think they hired somebody to do it.
I hope she didn't.
But it felt to me like a very old woman was updating something in the parlance that she thought that children were speaking in. And then some of the things were just like apropos of nothing or just tacked on. So this is par for the course. To humor her mother, Julie got up and went over to the telephone. She lifted the receiver, listened a moment, and set it down again. I can't call anyway. There's trouble with the line again. There isn't even a dial tone. And I left my cell phone in Ray's car.
Yeah,
exactly. This is what I mean. You're combining two things.
It's like just like adding a sentence.
Somebody who doesn't even know. Here's one. You know how kids are sometimes making crank calls and writing notes to people and sending spam?
Yes, bam.
Some kids, and then it says, so some kids decides to play a prank on people. He writes a dozen of these notes and sends to strangers right out of the phone book. So somebody is like, I'm going to use the word spam because that's an up to date. The kids are going to know spam.
Yeah.
But it goes right next to crank calls, writing notes. It was just
and
like
the phone book.
Somebody did not edit it after. Like,
no,
you're so right. The person they got to update it was like 63. And no offense, 63-year-olds, but you know, you're still wanting to leave in your, we were steadies. And
they
all
didn't
this
know
stuff
that steadies wasn't the word anymore.
There's and then so sometimes many of those it,
they
terms.
Were just like, the acrobatics were painful. I love this one. At some point, someone has proof of their crime in the form of a photograph. And so they're going to blackmail them. And he says, I'm willing to make a deal with you. I'd like to sell this picture plus the negative. It wasn't taken digitally, and I haven't scanned it. So that will be the end of it. I'm not asking you to buy it sight unseen. I'm calling from here on campus. I can show it to you. Like, they had to, they were like, well, wouldn't they just, they could just, like, keep a digital copy of it. So they have to say, it wasn't taken digitally.
See, I just think it's the person going, let's throw as many photo references in.
Yes.
Current and past. Let's do scanned. Let's do digital. Let's do negative. Let's do, like,
I haven't scanned it. I promise. I promise I haven't scanned it.
The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. The three of us have loved shopping for gifts at Uncommon Goods for years because we always find the coolest one-of-a-kind gifts for everyone on our list. Some of our recent favorites? An old-school red ViewMaster that spins your own photos, a word search throw blanket with 15 of your own words woven right in, mixtape art where you customize the playlist, all perfect for your hard-to-shop-for partner, by the way. Oh, and don't even get us started on the many unique advent calendars that we know our adult children will love. But it doesn't matter who you're shopping for. Kids, teens, book lovers, history buffs, diehard sports fans, foodies, mixologists, bird watchers, gardeners, and yes, retro pop culture lovers, you'll find thousands of new and unique gift ideas you won't find anywhere else. And we love this. With every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/PCPS. That's uncommongoods.com/PCPS for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
I just like some of the ones that just the 1973 references they left in.
Yes.
Are so like, so Leave It to Beaver. Like, we have, I don't even know the beginning of the sentence. I just wrote down the end of it, but because he was pretty burned up about my taking off last fall. He was burned up. And then here's
burned
one.
Up.
You'll have your chance, Elsa. You'll meet some nice boy. Like, you'll meet some, like, you'll have your chance. You'll become a wife. You'll meet
don't
some
worry.
Nice boy. Yeah, and then when at the end, when the tension's getting, their tension's getting so great, and oh my gosh, someone might be murdered, and I clobbered him with my flashlight.
Clobbered him.
And I wanted so bad to just see, in my head, I could just see, pow.
Kabam.
Bam.
Yeah.
You know.
And okay, you touched on the sexual politics of it all. They didn't, I mean, maybe they did, and I don't know, but they left in such egregious 1973 sexual politics. We're not blaming Lois Duncan. She was just writing how people thought in 1973. But if you're going to add in cell phones, you should probably take out things like this. If Pa was here, he could probably get your car started for you. I don't know a carburetor from a battery myself, but then I guess most girls don't, do they? She smiled at Julie. It was a wide, sweet smile that lit up her face.
It's so gross. Yeah. And then the you'll meet some nice boy, but I also wrote down gross things like this. The girl I was talking to was a real hot little number.
Oh, a hot little number.
There was the way the dads talked just in general about girls. And it was just so not of this time. Or there was a sentence that I wrote down. This is Helen, and she's was dreaming about these domestic evenings with Helen running around serving pot roast by candlelight were rough to handle. Like, Helen, that was her dream of if she was going to be with
Barry.
And she's 18 years old.
She's 18.
I mean,
well, yes.
That's okay.
Well, serving pot roast.
Can we address for just a second one of the most gross
ones?
That Helen, to me, this was the biggest one. It starts from the very beginning. Helen's big claim to fame is that she hasn't graduated high school, but she's the Channel 5 future star.
Future star.
That's mm-hmm. such a 1960s yes. thing. What, Kristen, would you please just explain to our listeners what they meant? Like, what did that mean?
Helen sent in a photograph of mm-hmm. herself and nothing else. No resume, no interview. Nowadays they say beauty pageants are scholarship pageants. They no longer say beauty pageants. There was nothing here except her photograph.
And they do say really quick, they try to make it current because I remember this specifically. They say it wasn't even Photoshopped.
Oh my God. Yes. They just tacked that on. So randomly. Based on her photograph, she is given a job at the local TV station to report on various innocuous things because of her photograph. Mm-hmm. And she's very proud of this.
Pretty.
She's so proud of this that she dropped out of high school. She doesn't need anything because of her pretty face. And so throughout the whole book, all we talk about is how pretty Helen is. And there's so much talk about her figure. There's so much objectification of women. It's painful. It's absolutely painful. But this is the most egregious, next to that one, I think. So when the topic of Barry and Helen getting married comes up, which, I mean, they're 18. Remember, they're 18. And because she wants to serve pot roast. And someone says she has a great job at the TV station. Barry says, screw that. I wouldn't want a wife of mine working.
That's
why
right.
would you leave that in?
Okay.
I don't know.
Carolyn's like ready to go off.
I am ready, but I'm going to let everyone say their thing before I explode.
Well, no, you go ahead. It's just so inconsistent. And you know what? You guys, reading it now, since they've updated it, I was way too distracted by all of this inconsistency.
Yeah.
And then it just became laughable. And then it almost became like a treasure hunt. How many yes. could I find? I was so distracted by that. That's all I could think about when reading it through.
It's a drinking game.
Week. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It'd be a great
I agree with you 110%, Michelle. I was so angry. I got angrier and angrier as I read this book.
Yeah.
And I am not kidding. Like I could start a petition about this because to me, the only reason that it was updated at all, it was motivated by dollars because
yes.
this movie was going to be coming out. They wanted to make it like, current and they wanted people to buy it again. Instead
yeah.
of, this is where I really can get upset. Instead of giving the reader kind of the benefit of the doubt that they might be kind of smart. It was very disturbing to me to think that they did not think the readers would be smart enough to understand this book if it was remained in 1973.
Yes, agreed.
Or would be dumb enough to just read it and think, oh, this all makes sense. Like,
right.
much like we're saying, those things stick out. It's distracting. You miss the whole premise of the story
yeah.
because you're all of a sudden thinking, this what are they talking about? What's bread? Like at one point he's like, oh, I had to go make some bread last summer.
Yeah.
You know, people are gonna think, is that a sourdough starter? People aren't gonna know that's what you're talking about. That was the term for money back in the 70s. It just made me so mad. So I looked up. I wanted to know, how often is this done? How often mm-hmm. do they take a book that especially might have meant something to a generation? We'll talk in a bit of the fact that this book has reading guides to go with it to be mm-hmm. taught in classrooms. It's not seen as just like junk fiction for
yeah.
kids. And so I thought, well, is this done often? Because this just is so bad. And so really, I could not find many other examples of this being done. I did read that some Nancy Drew Hardy Boy mysteries had been updated,
okay.
mostly because of outdated stereotypes, you know, some kind of racist thing, some things
gotcha.
That just you wouldn't want to perpetuate.
Yeah.
So it was pretty much Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys. They mentioned Goosebumps and some stuff
okay.
like that, which led me to think about books that I read as a youngster or a kid that left an impression on me. Those Beverly Cleary books,
yeah.
those Sister
yeah.
of the Bride, 15. Mm-hmm. I loved those
loved
books.
Those, I did too.
I read those in the 70s. They were written back in the early 60s about, you know, teens
or
in
earlier.
The late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in early 60s. And I enjoyed that aspect of it.
Knowing
that kind
it came
of,
before.
Yes,
you knew
exactly.
That. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's like historical fiction.
Yeah.
It is. Well, that's exactly
exactly what I kind of wrote here. All of the aspects of this book that you lost when you tried to update it but didn't do it in the right way. I mean, everything from that, the historic authenticity of it, right? Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. if we had talked about the correct war that this...
Oh my God. The timeline is so... I'm so sorry to interrupt you.
That's a dialogue.
They present a story problem by trying to update the... The text. So in the original, the bad guy, the villain, has just returned from Vietnam. So in the 2010 update, they make that the Iraq War. But it's 2010. But he came back from Iraq. But they have cell phones. I didn't know anybody with a cell phone. And by the way, if he came back from Iraq, is 17-year-old Julie dating a 40-year-old man?
It doesn't make sense. It's so inconsistent. I'm confused. Plus, some of the times when it would say, like, we're going to meet at Starbucks,
yes.
I would stop right. and I would go, okay,
for
I want to try.
For a coffee cake. Not just a coffee. Leave it at coffee.
But I wanted to try to figure out, okay, so what do you think it said in the original? Like, did it say, did the corner diner? No.
Or the coffee shop.
But a lot of the times, you guys, I would say, like, at least half of the times, they just added sentences
totally.
In. One time, Barry just randomly was going to go to Wendy's and get a Frosty.
Yeah.
Random.
Just randomly.
Random.
These are things that don't even add to the story, don't make sense. And they were just throwing them in like, we need to make this current.
It's always tacked on.
But we still have all the old stuff in there.
Right. And we're not going to take the time to read through it and see if this makes sense. And it was so, this is what makes me so mad. It was lazy.
At the end of the day, it was just lazy.
Yes. And again, that annoys me as a reader. And I, right now, probably more than any time of my life, am very sensitive to being, you know, talked down to or thought I'm not smart enough to think for myself or I can't figure things out. It's just right at the surface. So this book, I was just like, this is so incredibly lazy. I mean, it was just like you said, Michelle, just sticking in a random sentence or tacking one thing onto an existing sentence. And it would say, and a cell phone.
And then I texted him. The line was dead. So I texted
him. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I was getting
those
a busy signal.
Things were so annoying too, because this book really works only because it was written in a pre-digital era.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. It's like they had to justify the fact that it was in the digital era. But so then don't make it historical fiction.
How about it's historical fiction and you have these opportunities in a classroom or whatever to talk about those things we said, the misogynistic, dialogue, the ways that, what else? Just the fat phobia. I mean, there was a whole like body type, all of these kinds of things.
So much fat phobia.
Women's
role. Oh my God. Seriously.
So you could talk about that and the war. You could talk about Vietnam and the demonstrations. I mean, there was a whole part of the storyline where they're talking about they were having war demonstrations. If you think this was written in 2010, I mean, now I could see, okay, there could be some demonstrations on campus.
Right, but not 2010.
No, not 2010. Mm-mm. Not really since the Vietnam War. We never had anything like
because
that.
Because even Iraq was not like it was in Vietnam.
No, right, exactly.
It was not a daily part of the high schooler's experience it was for Vietnam.
Right, the conversations that you could have in a classroom. And also the fact that it does highlight some universal themes that no matter if it's 1940, 1973, 2010, that are continuous throughout time, like peer pressure and making a right decision or how one wrong decision can really affect the rest of your life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's so much richness in the story without the other stuff that you really dumbed it down.
Yes, they dumbed it down and they made it more confusing. It would have been a straightforward story, but now you're 13 years old and you're going, I'm so confused. When was the Iraq War again?
Right.
And the whole premise is dependent on it being in a digital age is the argument for it remaining unupdated.
Yeah.
The pre-digital age, mm-hmm. right? Because when you're driving down the road and you hit a boy, and what are you going to do? You're going to pull out your cell phone and you're going to call 911. And so then they have to do these acrobatics in the car like, no, don't call 911. We'll just wait till we get to town and then we'll call an ambulance. Well, why would you wait to get to town to call an ambulance when you have a cell phone in your pocket? Would you just told me you did? Like, there's no justification for it. It was just going around in circles.
It was all so wildly inconsistent that, Carolyn, you're so right. The point of the book and the themes of the book, all of it gets so lost.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, let's just go to the very basic. It wouldn't have even been a note that said, I know what you did last summer. It would be a text.
It would have been a text. Or an email, something.
Or no, it would be a snap. It'd be a snap, so it disappeared. Yep.
Or you'd get hacked or something. Like, it would appear digitally somewhere and freak you out. Yeah, the whole thing is pre-digital.
So I'm confused. How did we all feel about this reread?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Was it a good experience or a bad experience? Okay, I'll give you one good thing that actually brought me just a tiny little bit of joy. And it's not technically sexual politics of 1973, but it is very 1973, and it is not something that you would see today. And the quote is, Mrs. James was kneeling on the floor, cutting around a dress pattern. She straightened up with a gasp. Why, Julie? How awful. Yes. And just the image of my mother on the floor cutting around a dress pattern. Mm-hmm. It's not that people don't sew today. They do. And God bless you. We love you. And you're selling all of the stuff that we buy on Etsy. But in those days, all of our moms were on the floor cutting out a dress pattern.
Absolutely. Totally. Did your moms have that big cardboard thing that folded it, tri-folded?
Right. When she said that, I was imagining, because my mom wasn't on the floor. We had a pool table that really I bet we played 3 games of pool on it in 5 years. It was for folding laundry. And it was for my mom cutting out patterns. It was in the basement, you know. But that's where, and so right when she said that, Carolyn, I pictured it folded like an accordion kind of.
Yeah.
And it had all the lines on it.
So yes, all the lines. And then my mom would have those pinking shears. Do you remember those?
Yes.
And then sometimes those were the only scissors you could find in that. Well, they like had the little
jaggedy. Oh, yeah, there's the rolly one too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so sometimes at my house, like, I could only find pinking shears to cut something out. And it would be like, I mean.
Did you guys get, I can't even describe the amount of trouble I would be in if I was ever caught using any of my mom's sewing scissors.
Yes.
Naughty.
Yes.
Don't you touch
terribly
them.
Bad.
Don't you do it. Don't do it.
And this is reminding me of one other thing I want to ask you that has nothing to do with anything, except did your mom use those pins that had like the little colored balls on the end?
Yes.
Like
in a tomato.
We just always had the flat. My whole childhood memory is being stuck with pins when my mom
would Michelle,
come here. I need to measure, you know, I need to try this on you. And she would have like 15 of them in her mouth.
My mom talking with her mouth. Like, there's
and
a whole.
Would sit there while she was pinning, and I was constantly getting pins under my armpits or in my thigh.
But the ones with the little balls, I would take a couple, and those would be the pierced earrings for my Barbie dolls. So they would have little, I thought I was so cool.
That.
But sometimes
were they really long?
Yeah, they were. Sometimes that wasn't always good. I had to do them like angle them down a little, or they would come out like Frankenstein or something like out of her
fingers to their neck, the back of their head.
So I had to put it where there was enough space so the other one wouldn't come
out
on the other side.
That's
so good.
I wish I'd thought of that.
I know.
Okay, can we talk about the ending of the book for a minute? Because when I read the ending of the book, I texted Carolyn and I'm like, I don't get it. I just was so confused because I read the last line of the book and they turned the page for what came next and there was nothing. It was just acknowledgments. I'm like, wait, what?
I had done the same thing.
So I'm going to read the end of the book to you people, to you listeners, and then we're going to discuss. But this is, I'm going to give it an award. It is the award for the lamest ending I've ever read in my whole life because the book feels unfinished.
It does.
So the way, and this is not spoilers. We're spoiling it for you, but you're not going to read it. You just need to have this information. In the end, the man who has sent the note turns out to be a man that Julie has been dating. Oops. And also Helen has been dating. His name is Bud. And so Julie was dating the same guy. Helen was dating the same guy. That man was, unbeknownst to them, the older brother of the boy they killed. And he was out for revenge. So he shot Barry. He came after Helen. He tried to strangle Julie. And then this is how the book ends. Ray, discovering Julie, blacked out on the floor after being attacked by Bud. And Ray says, she wakes up and he says, "You don't have to worry. He's not going to be doing anything much for a while. I clobbered him with a flashlight from behind." It's not the way the good guys do it on television, but there wasn't time to think about that. Also, we were led to believe that Ray walked in on Bud strangling Julie, but we don't actually know because she doesn't tell us. She just blacks out and she wakes up with Ray going, Julie, Julie, come out of it, Julie. So aloud, she said, why not you, Ray? You were involved as much as the rest of us. Why is it that Bud never tried to do anything to you? He did, Ray said softly, tonight. His arm tightened around her. He knew the worst punishment for me would be to stay alive in a world that didn't have you in it. End scene. And this is what I wrote in my note. Where the fuck is Bud? There's a killer on the loose, and you guys are just going to end the book right here? This also feels like my eighth grade creative writing project.
Also, me going forward, going, they're going to come clean, but now, like, are they going to be in jail? They're going to have to go to jail. Yes. You can't explain this away.
Right.
Like, you still broke the law and killed a child.
Yes. Are you going to jail? Is there a trial? Are you going to the cops?
Well, maybe that's why it was like taught in schools or whatever. Maybe Lois Duncan's whole thing was, let's have these discussions in classrooms now. What happened after? Like, you know, she didn't hand that to us on a silver platter. Are they going to tell? You know, whatever. But I agree with you. I was the same way in that I went to turn the page and there was nothing more there. Although I wonder back when I read it, if at that age I wasn't like enamored with his final declaration, yes. Like, oh, it would have been cruel to know that you weren't here anymore. And maybe my little, you know, 12-year-old heart was just like, oh, beating so fast, like happily ever after. And maybe I was satisfied. I don't know.
But where's
Bud? Would you like to know why Lois Duncan ended it that way?
Oh, please.
Oh, my God. Please tell me.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I have this little interview with a young adult author named Barry Lyga, L-Y-G-A. And he says, now the book ends before we can learn what will happen to the main characters for covering up the hit and run. Mm-hmm. And I assume that was intentional on your part. You wanted to end the book there. I'm curious, what was your reason? And she says, there's a natural cutoff point for every story. And I thought we reached it. It's when you know that Julie's going to survive and the questions have been answered as to why things happened. I felt the book came to closure there. And to go on spinning along for another few chapters, adding things on, would be an anticlimax, to say the least.
Nope.
I've done that with all my books. I've ended the story as soon after the climax as I could because I've seen too many books written by authors who just don't know when to stop. So,
well, okay. I understand what she's saying. Yes, that sometimes there is an end point and you're like, stop right now. But that wasn't it because the killer is out there. Like, we don't even know where he is. We just know he clobbered him with a flashlight. But did you kill him? You didn't say that you killed him. In my mind, he got clobbered and then he ran away. Isn't he going to come back? And I also am a little peeved with Lois for robbing us of the scene in which Ray discovers Bud attacking Julie and clobbers him with the flashlight.
Right.
Doesn't that seem like a good scene we'd want to be in on instead of him just going, don't worry, I clobbered him with a flashlight.
Yes. Well, I'm going to go back to what Carolyn said earlier. I love that. She said, it's lazy. I think, sorry, Lois Duncan, but that was lazy
tired.
Too.
Yeah.
It was lazy.
There are some books that I feel do that where they get to that resolution in terms of, okay, now we know who did it. And I'm tired. I've been writing this for a long time. And then, because all of a sudden we go from him strangling her to she's waking up and her mom's talking to her. And I was like, where's the, like, did they forget a chapter or something? I just, again, it was lazy. She probably thought, oh, my deadline's coming up. And yeah, so
we'll
I just
end it here. Yeah, we'll just end it. It's fine. But think about from the movie perspective, would you have ever left that scene out of the movie in which Ray discovers Bud strangling Julie? You would never leave that out.
No,
That's the climax. So she's thinking, I don't know what she thinks is the climax, but that's the climax and she left it out. It's really weird.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it begs the question then, what is its role as a young adult classic? We now do have young adult literature. She pioneered it. She was one of the pioneers of young adult literature. She's one of the highest selling authors of all time. It's in classrooms. There are new adaptations. There are movies. So why is it a classic? But do you think it deserves this status? How do we feel? Because we've kind of taken it apart right here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, like, I'm going to go back to Carolyn's point earlier, another one you made, Carolyn, about there were good maybe like themes or good discussion points.
Mm-hmm.
that you could take the book and then run with your classroom. I just think that they changed a lot of them. But I think, you know, I think you can get into things like, okay, they've all made this pact, but now some of them are like having, you know, this whole moral dilemma of, I don't think we should have made that pact. I want to go tell. And this is a good discussion. So
yeah.
I think the book and the plot, you're going to get kids to read, which is always your number one goal as a teacher, right? I'm going to give you this book, and you tell kids, they hit this kid and then they cover it up. And then he's like, I know what you did. That's juicy. That's
every
enticing.
Kid wants that.
I want to read that. So let's get our kids to read first.
Yes.
So excellent. And yes, you absolutely could start talking about, was this right? You could start talking about a lot of the different issues and the moral dilemma that they go through. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, I think, yes. Mm-hmm. Does, as a teacher, do you have to think that the book that I'm going to use as a lit study in my class is, you know, a Secret Garden-esque type book? Is it, you know, the best book I've ever read? No, because like I keep saying, you want to get your kids reading.
All of the kids.
And then it's almost your job as the teacher to start trying to figure out, now, how can we learn from this? So for that reason, I say yes, because I do think I do think kids would be very interested in the premise of this book.
The premise is gold. I think the premise is
from everything I said, I think they wrecked it with the updates. And so because of that, no, I wouldn't.
Okay. So the update, you would not.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
The 1973.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because I think she had a great idea with this premise. I think it's juicy. Kids want to read it.
Two things I want to say, because I don't know when it would have first been considered a classic. I mean, were teachers using it in real time in like 1975 in classrooms?
That's a good question.
And when did it start to be used? Because I think the 1973 version has a lot of teachable moments beyond the moral themes and that kind of stuff. You could even talk about showing and not telling. I mean, there was writing, particular pieces of writing.
Show
that
Ray
you could
clobbering
use.
Him with a flashlight instead of telling us.
Well, exactly that, or how you create suspense without being gory or whatever. Like, she was really good in that aspect of her writing. Do you use the updated version? Because I want to say, I looked, and I think you did too, Kristen, high and low for the 1973 version. I wanted to read the one that I originally read. It is impossible to find. Obviously, it's out of print because the one that's getting printed is this 2010, who knows, 2021 they might have done. So I don't know that a teacher could have access to a 1973 class set of books. But how interesting would it be to read the current one and find all the things that are wrong with it? And teach it like that, as looking at it through a writer's eyes, or getting both copies and comparing the updates to the original, you know, good or bad.
Yeah.
So I guess the term classic, you know, to me, it's a classic for different reasons, because it was, again, the first book like this that I read, first time I'm starting to feel grown up. Obviously, our generation has these reference points to that that we've already talked about, the title of the book and stuff. But to be like in a classroom and taught as a classic alongside, you know, whatever, Catcher in the Rye or something like that.
The Giver, right.
The Giver, Terabithia. I don't think so. But depending on what your angle is with it, I guess. But classic, no. I think that's going a little too far.
I think if we designate like very specifically young adult classic, I think it has enough historical significance that I would designate it a young adult classic. Because if you think about it, before, and I've already said this, before Lois Duncan and a handful of others, you consider like The Outsiders and things like that, there was no young adult literature. There were children's books and there were adult books. Catcher in the Rye is about teens, but it is an adult book. So if you were in, if you were 13, you were probably reading adult books. So in that way, it has, and she was one of the first people to do that. I'm writing books for teens, about teens. And so it really does have historical significance, because look where we are now with this entire genre that is one of the best-selling genres that we have in print. The writing may not be what would get published today, but it was a trailblazer in creating a whole new audience of readers. So I'm designating it a young adult classic. I can't imagine teaching it in a classroom. That's ridiculous. It would only be in What Not to Do. I would love to teach about it historically, like to look at things from another era. But I do think that it's
it just once again points out that we Gen Xers, we're not just the big wheel generation and the Sesame Street generation. We're literally the young adult literature generation. Mm-hmm. Like we were the 70s were the first time, I guess The Outsiders was like 1967, but that lit the spark, right? Yeah. The Outsiders lit the spark. And then here we go. And it's all thanks to our generation. Or maybe I shouldn't say thanks to our generation. We were the beneficiaries of all of that.
I think this should be our new KTEL record that we're looking for. Remember when, and we were all looking for that one KTEL record that Kristen didn't have? In vintage stores. Right now, our mission is anytime we're at a used bookstore, we need to start looking for this book.
I know
the 1973.
Yes.
Excellent. Also, at the back of my Kindle edition, it does have reader discussion questions. And so I do see a lot of value now that I've just kind of glanced through these, especially with kids that might want to pick it up, you know, like a lot of moral issue type things. Like, even though we can say, okay, it's not a great lesson in how well a book should be written.
Yeah.
But look at like this question. A lot of different elements led to little Daniel's death. Do you think Barry is most responsible? Is Daniel's mom responsible in some way for not picking him up from his friend's house? Can more than one person be responsible for a tragic event? Why do you think this is? I mean, my God, there's a journal question for your students right there.
There's
about 20 of them like this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I now I'm reading these and I'm like, okay, maybe you could, you know, teach it still. And you could say this was a classic back. I don't know.
Yeah.
Not that anybody is really pulling this one to teach as a classic, but I don't know that even though we were all very negative about the updates, I do still think maybe the book has value.
Oh, 100%. And I, again, put it back in that time frame of when it was written. Mm-hmm. And we talk, even Judy Blume, the way she wrote, it seems like that era of writing was kind of
more simplistic.
Short sentences. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of to the
really
point.
It really was.
And I think with the exception of that ending, that was kind of weird. And then, of course, all of the updates, that's really what
killed it.
What made it bad. I mean, I can see all of those questions being answered and asked during if you read the 1973.
And can you imagine updating Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret? Like what a travesty that would be.
It's terrible.
Terrible. Right. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, I think really my favorite part of reading this book was going back to 1973, which gives us that reason to start looking for. I don't need it to be a 1973 issue that we, you know, edition. It can be a 1980s edition as long as it's like a 1980s cover, as long as it's the 1973 text. We need the 1973 text. Yes. I really did in the places where you felt 1973, I really did feel like I went back to 1973, even though they were trying to make me believe I was in the present day, but it did not work. The whiff of 1973 is too strong on this book. Just like Margaret, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, has a whiff of 1970, and I want it to stay there.
Yes.
So that's why finding a 1973 copy would be so great.
I know.
And truthfully, if you're looking for a distraction from the news, a way to like escape the nightmare of what's happening outside for just a few minutes each day, reading something you read when you were a kid will lift you out of this timeline and put you into another, just temporarily. Even if it doesn't live up to your expectations or if it lands with a thud, that's okay. You still got to time travel a little bit. And that's not nothing. It's almost like a form of dissociating a little bit, which is, it's a legit coping mechanism. Let's just say.
I was just about to
100%.
Say, I call it survival.
That's right. Whatever it takes. So they weren't kidding on those read posters when they said, reading can take you anywhere. It really can. Thank you for listening today, and we will see you next time. I know what you did last summer. Just lie to me, there's no
other. I know what you did last summer. And before we go, a huge thank you to our Patreon supporters. You help keep the mics on, the memories alive, and the pop culture love flowing. We couldn't do this without you, so consider this your official shout out. And today we are giving a specific shout out, I guess I could say, to these patrons: Bonnie, Lori, Liz, James, Maria, Sian, S-I-A-N, that's a cool name, Richard, Laura, Shannon, Jen, Teresa, Dawn, Melissa, and Annabelle. And if you're enjoying the Pop Culture Preservation Society and want to join our community of patrons, just head over to patreon.com to learn more about the different tiers and exclusive perks available to our supporters.
And we thank you all. In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of Lois Duncan. Thank you, Lois Duncan, for this historic book. And from the cast of Three's Company. To good times.
To happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Cheers!
Bye-bye. Cheers! The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.